This is Ben Habib for Our Voice, Politics Albury Wodonga. We're joined now on the Electorate of Farah Candidates Forum by Liberal Party candidate Susan Lee. I caught up with Susan earlier at her Albury office. Okay, Susan Lee, welcome to the Farah Candidates Forum podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, we'll start off talking about some local issues. First off, what do you think you've done well as the member for Farah since 2001? What are some of your successes?
Well, one of the major successes in this region has been the resolution after 30-odd years of the internal Hume Highway bypass, so the new road that we now all drive on between northeast Victoria and Albury. I've been very proud of previous coalition government achievements around school funding, investing in our schools, program that gave money to the schools and they decided what to do with it rather than tell them that they needed a certain particular product, as I believe we're seeing with the school halls program that's happening now. Look, GPs in rural areas has been something that everyone in my electorate has had issues with, and I think with our GP networks we've addressed a lot of that. We've certainly seen the need decrease. You would always say, as someone like me interested in economics, that our job is to put the right economic conditions in place for businesses to prosper. And I would say that that hasn't happened over the last 3 years of the Labor government. And I guess that's one of the main messages I'm taking to the campaign, on the campaign trail in various forms in the next few weeks.
Great. Okay, Farah is a vast electorate by any standards, and it's got a lot of diverse communities with different needs. Now, I know I'm setting you a bit of a task here, but how would you describe the people who live in Farah, the people who vote for you?
Well, to the extent that they're all Australians, they have that in common, and they all live in New South Wales, they have that in common. Beyond that, there really are some quite significant differences. The large regional centre of Albury, which is 34% of the constituents that I represent, has an identity that's very focused on the fact that it's a transport, manufacturing, university, health, and a lot of other things besides town between Sydney and Melbourne, and it has links to the rural areas around it, and it depends on them, but not totally. Broken Hill is at the other end of my electorate, and its foundation is in mining, tourism, but it also has a large welfare community, as do a lot of the small towns, and that's increasingly becoming so. I was in Deniliquin yesterday, and remarks were made about the increased number of welfare families given the downturn in so many rural industries. In other parts of the electorate, the nature of the activity, whether it be irrigated agriculture, wheat farming, the Western Division pastoral areas, forestry, defines the towns and the villages in those areas. But we've got to remember we live in a globally interconnected world, so that what we're seeing in those differences now probably won't be there nearly so much in another generation, because the children of the farmers that have lived there and been on the land for generations are now finding that their aspirations are certainly not necessarily local, they're not necessarily Australian, they're global. So, and they're bringing back so much of what they see and experience in the world back to small local areas, and I'm just seeing the beginnings of that, and I think over time when that picks up, it'll make the region fascinating, but it will still be defined by its landscapes.
Great. Now, you've just touched on young people. What do you think are some of the issues facing young people in the electorate?
Well, there are immediate issues like whether they can get youth allowance under the old rules, if I can use that term, and some rural areas can, but Albury can't. And that's something that I'm just so disappointed about when the changes finally went through the Senate last year or earlier this year. I felt that many rural students were being let down and creating two classes of students. So being able to support yourself while at university is absolutely critical. I've got a daughter at university and one doing year 12 and an older son who's in trades. So I've seen a lot of what's happened to them, their peer group and their friends, and I know that when you're studying and you're young, it comes down to money. And unless you can get that sorted, then you don't really have the time, the effort and the energy to put into the study that you really want to do. And if we reflect on the old days when people wandered into universities, and I know that the poor generally didn't get to go to university in my grandmother's time, but people sort of read what they liked and did what they liked and amused themselves. It's such a different world now because students, in every cafe in town, I'll talk to a university student, he'll tell me how many hours work they have to do to support their study. It's a big issue. So that's, I think, something that all students are facing. Beyond that, I don't think you can say young people care more about maybe climate change, maybe economic management, maybe health. I guess that they all have different views. I wouldn't like to put them all in the same basket on issues.
Yeah, great. And what about the wider community, places like Albury and surrounds in the southeastern corner of your electorate? What are some of the key problems facing this region?
Well, a lot of people are telling me, though they're employed, they're underemployed. Mm-hmm. They haven't got as much work as they want. They don't therefore appear in the job statistics, but they're not happy in their work. Mm-hmm. Small businesses are telling me that it's quiet. Retail is slowing down. We're sort of at this funny stage where the global financial crisis is supposedly over, but it's not really if you talk to people. There's a bit of anxiety about the future, which is reducing confidence. And I just put it down to confidence when it comes to risking money to make investments. And if people are confident and they're prepared to take risks, whether it be in business or in their personal life, moving into a different job sphere, making a jump and having that level of confidence about the future, then it's very contagious. And I see that is fading a little bit at the moment for a number of reasons. So I think we're at an interesting time in the political and economic cycle.
Mm-hmm. The urban-rural divide is alive and well when it comes to service provision in this region. Why does this continue to be the case, you think? And how do the communities within Farrer fit into the Liberal Party's vision for regional Australia?
There is an urban-regional divide, but it's actually, I think, on the Great Divide. So even if you're west of Newcastle, Sydney and Wollongong, you will experience it. Then there's another tier, which would be Albury and Wagga. And then if you head out to the far west of New South Wales, it's almost like another country when it comes to that divide. So the challenge is always to bridge it and how to do that in the best possible way. And one of the things I've always said is that rather than expect the 80% of Australians who live on the coast to take on our issues, many of which they can't understand and won't have experienced, what we have to do is bring some experience of ourselves to them, which is why I'm in the Liberal Party, not the National Party, because I see the Liberal Party as bringing everyone together under that broad church, that broad umbrella, rather than being a sort of rebel yell from the rural edge of the spectrum, demanding certain policy changes and demanding government action. We will never bridge that population divide. It will always be, I think, pretty much where it is. We don't want it to get any worse. So we have to get the people in the city to take on our issues, and that's the challenge, and that's the Liberal Party challenge too.
Yeah, great. Very interesting answer. Thanks for that. Let's move on now to the state of politics in Australia, and I think this is something that it's important for candidates of all political stripes to think about. Political debate in this country has been reduced to a series of short soundbites, PR slogans, and a focus on the personalities of leaders, as opposed to more emphasis on detailed policy analysis. The public gets bombarded with cheap slogans like the ALP's moving forward mantra and the Coalition's great big new tax line, to name but a few. In your opinion, why is this kind of discourse necessary in politics, given that everyone does it?
It's fascinating that it has in fact reached this point, and I've even noticed that the trend for the grab, the slogan, the personalisation of individuals rather than their politics has even got more so in the 9 years that I've been in politics. And There are some days I quite honestly despair about it. People may say that's how politicians are and that's their fault. But can I tell you that we actually don't want to be like that? I would prefer nothing more than a genuine face-to-face discussion about real issues with someone. And if they want to bring personalities in, they're quite welcome to, but as long as the policies are the substance of it. But I think that television drives most of what we do at the moment. And television demands an approach that's based on, number one, appearance, number two, personality, as in quirkiness, interest, something about how you sound and what you say that makes you stand out from the crowd. That makes good television. And people's concentration and the range of information they have means that they've got a lot of other information that they're far more interested in, like Sex in the City or MasterChef or the fact that they're on Facebook talking to, what is it now, 500 million users across the world. So our own lives have devolved into sound bites in what we do and what we say and how we behave. And so politics is following that. But the thing that frustrates me, particularly about the election campaign, is that, and I notice this, is that every single interviewer is interviewing every single politician based only on how to catch them out on something that they say. And if that's the approach of the media, and if that happens and their answer goes to somewhere that can be described as a slip-up or a gaffe, and every other single media outlet then jumps on it, which they do, and then it becomes the news story of the day, and it might even hit the 7 o'clock bulletin. If as a politician you're faced with that, you are only ever going to give glib, boring, flat answers, and then you're going to repeat them over and over again. So I think the media really does need to take some responsibility for this, and we all need to recognise that it's not good for any of us.
Yep. Okay, do you think this style of superficial politics and some members of the community getting fed up with that will lead to the major parties hemorrhaging votes to alternative political parties in Australia?
Look, I don't think so. We always hear this at every election, and sometimes there are... we saw it in the British election when the Liberal Democrats apparently had well over 15% of the vote in some polls. But then on election day, that wasn't actually the final result. So it's always talked about, and there's always a general commentary that the major political parties are no good and it's time for more independence. But I don't think we're seeing much of a trend of that over time. We really aren't. So I actually think when voting day comes, there's an enormous silent majority. They haven't paid much attention during the campaign. They're not interested in politics particularly. They know what they're going to vote and they have their own reasons for doing it, and they just quietly vote. And nearly always it's for one of the major two parties.
Yep. Okay, let's move on now and talk about climate change. I'll ask you a few questions on that. This issue has cost the coalition two leaders and a lot of internal strife during this parliamentary term. The coalition harbours a number of climate change sceptics. What's your personal position on the climate change issue?
I believe in climate change and I believe it's real, and I believe that we need to take action. I'm not a climate change sceptic, but I would describe myself as a bit of a climate change agnostic. I think that it was ludicrous for Australia to sign up to a carbon price before the rest of the world did, and after we saw what happened at Copenhagen, I think that view was clear, I think, to most Australians that had we done that, we would have been in a very, very difficult position. But I would not like to see, and I don't see, any side of politics walking away from the challenge of climate change. And I think the position that we now have as a Liberal Party is a good one, because even if even with the uncertainty about the degree of human-induced climate change, or we've got to face it, though, I have many constituents who are sceptics, is that our approach covers all bases. Even if you don't believe in climate change, you have to believe, you have to accept that we need to reduce our emissions and we have to reduce our usage of fossil fuels because they're a finite resource in the earth. So our approach is that you have a bucket of money, and if you can demonstrate that you can reduce emissions, use less fuel, then you have access to that money to fund programs, whether it be on a local, a household, or a even a wider basis. And I think that that meets a lot of needs. And climate change academics, if I can put it that way, or people that study these things, have acknowledged that it will reduce emissions. It's a really good start.
Mm-hmm. The electorate of Farah straddles a large slab of the Murray-Darling Basin, an area that you could describe as ground zero for climate change impacts in Australia. So you've just briefly introduced the Coalition's climate change plan, the Direct Action Plan. How will this lessen the blow for the people of Farah of climate change impacts?
Well, I wouldn't say that the Murray-Darling Basin is ground zero at all. I would say somewhere like the Maldives in the world context, and you have to look at climate change in a world context, is probably ground zero. In fact, the temperature of the Murray-Darling Basin has gone down, not up, and that's a localised effect, and I don't use that to say that climate change is not a reality, because I've already said I think it is. But I don't agree that the Murray-Darling Basin is a particular ground zero. But I think where you might be coming from is that we've experienced some pretty savage years of drought. But I agree with the late Peter Cullen, who we didn't agree on many things, but we had very good conversations around them nevertheless, when he said that our climate here is essentially 40 years of dry, followed by 40 years that are wetter than normal, followed by 40 years that are drier than normal. And if you put our experience since white settlement in that context, it makes an awful lot of sense. So we shouldn't be... carried away by saying what's happening is climate change and therefore we have to respond in a certain way. I think what's happening is the Australian climate manifesting itself. And yes, it might be getting a bit drier in the driest stages and a bit, it might even be getting a bit wetter in the wet stages, because that's also a feature that can be seen in certain climate change scenarios. But we have to be on the front foot when it comes to farmers, agriculture, and how we respond to these challenges. And I don't think that the current government's policy of buying back water, taking it out of the system without a plan for what to do with it, has done us any good at all in this region. And it certainly hasn't made farmers and rural communities want to sign up to doing something about climate change. And that's a pity.
Mm-hmm. Are you advocating bringing renewable energy projects to the electorate?
Look, renewable energy is a key part of both political parties' platforms. West of Broken Hill, at a place called Silverton, there's probably one of in the planning process, one of the biggest wind farms, I think, in maybe the Southern Hemisphere, if it ever gets off the ground, and it's terrific. I've been very interested in watching the development of that project, and the Hay Plain has put itself forward as being somewhere where we could have enormous solar generation. I think when it comes to solar, that it's fine to have panels on roofs, and there's a place for that, but we also need to have very large scale projects where we realise the efficiencies of, you know, a huge solar panel sitting on the hottest plain in Australia, getting the most sun it possibly can, and consider the amount of energy that could put back into the grid. The other thing I would say about renewables, though, is we have to be careful that we don't go too far down the road of mandating a certain proportion of renewable energy. People are really struggling with their electricity bills, and there's got to be a path that we take that doesn't mean that those on lower incomes and fixed incomes can't afford the electricity to heat their homes. That would not be a good outcome.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to pose you a question I'm asking directly of all the candidates that I've interviewed, both in Farah and in Indore, because I think the answers that come say a lot about the candidates' long-term vision for climate change adaptation and economic sustainability. So here it is. To grow the economy necessarily entails increasing resource consumption and greenhouse gas pollution. So do you think, therefore, given that we live on a finite planet, that perpetual economic growth is possible in the long run?
It's a long time. It's probably since I was at university that I would have had a question like that posed to me. It's a terrific question. I think we have to be optimistic about perpetual economic growth and not just see it in terms of numbers of people. I think we have to see it in terms of the resources that people consume over time becoming less on a per capita basis worldwide. And I don't think anyone should feel comfortable about some of the level of resource consumption that individual people have in their lives today in large houses with LCD televisions and split systems and cars and so on. But at the same time, I wouldn't take the approach that the Greens would take to that, which is to want a mandate against it somehow. Economic growth has been the single reason for our standard of living increasing from something that we now see in other parts of the developing world to what it is now. So unless we have economic growth, we're pretty doomed, and we have to accept that. So the challenge is to get the economic growth parameters such that they include as many people in the world as possible, and that we don't leave developing countries too far behind, but that we as individuals recognise that we must try to walk lightly on the earth and be very aware of the of our resource consumption. But I certainly don't agree in regulations and government interference to bring about certain goals and certain targets and certain restraints. I mean, I'm one of the key features of the liberal philosophy is that we don't do that, and that when governments interfere, they don't usually get it right. But these are questions that we should all think about, that we should all concern ourselves with. Population is increasing at a very rapid rate, and I don't know, maybe that's not sustainable on a global scale to the extent that we all think it is, but maybe it is, because we are getting so much better and technology has so many answers for so many problems. So my approach is I'm optimistic about the future, but I don't think there's a reason to close off your mind to all of the possibilities, some of them negative.
No, it's a good topic to think about, and something that I know a lot of people would like to hear more of a debate about across the political spectrum. So thanks for your answer for that. Let's move on now to the economy. What's your vision for stimulating the economic vitality of communities in Farah?
Well, I don't think the government has a role in stimulus unless there's a dramatic collapse, which we saw in the global financial crisis. Many people felt that the Liberal Party's approach was to say no economic stimulus. In fact, it wasn't. But it was to say a much reduced economic stimulus from the one that the government has given us.
Sorry, I think I might have used an inappropriate word in stimulating
okay.
now.
Okay, well, we'll move away from the politics of the word stimulus. It always it fires
perhaps.
Us up.
Yes. Yeah.
The economy. Look, I believe that the best outcomes for the economy locally, regionally and nationally comes from the innovation and enterprise of individuals who have an environment in which they want to invest their money in, they want to take risks, and they want to be brave with big, bold ideas. And that can, in many cases, lead the way. It certainly has to lead the way in our area, because we are not public service towns in this area. We certainly, I mean, Albury was a target for the Whitlam-Barnard vision of decentralisation. It's one of the reasons why I've got the tax office here in 600 people, which has been a good thing. But generally, we are not areas that are going to attract public jobs. So we have to rely on the private sector, and we have to rely, and that includes agriculture, small business in towns and industry. And we have to make sure that government policies don't take away the opportunities that are there. And by removing as much water from the system as we've seen, which has been devastating for irrigated agriculture, by closing down the forests of the New South Wales Murray, which has been devastating for a sustainable forest industry, we've actually removed huge drivers of economic growth in our area.
Great. Now to a broader economic question about global capitalism and where it's at and how that relates back to people in Australia. So the global financial crisis has morphed into a sovereign debt crisis, which many analysts argue has some way to run. Now, debt, both public and private, lies at the centre of these crises. What's your opinion of A, Australia's level of government debt, and B, the disturbing levels of private debt assumed by households and individuals in Australia?
Well, there are different views on private debt. There are different views, of course, on public debt too. I think that since the global financial crisis, people's personal borrowings have been coming down. And I don't think there's any trend that has them going sharply up, but I could be wrong. On the matter of public debt, we on our side of politics are quite concerned, and you'll hear in this election campaign the figure of $100 million a day being paid back, and I rang into ABC Radio yesterday to actually explain what that meant, because it seemed that people didn't quite think that it was a real number. And what it is the deficit for 2010-2011 is forecast to be, or will be, about $40 billion. And if you divide that by 365, you have, I think, $109 million every day. So that's where that comes from. Now, that is of concern because it didn't take Australia very long to get from a $22 billion surplus to a $40 billion debt. In fact, the debt this year was $57 billion. So we've deteriorated quite quickly. Now, trying to keep to a sense of two sides of the argument here. The other side of the argument would say, yes, but we had a global financial crisis and it was necessary to go into debt. I accept that to a point, but not to the degree that we did go into debt and not to the degree that we're still going into debt. So we've got dollars that contribute to our future debt that have yet to be spent on school stimulus projects, which add very little productive value to the economy. And most people would argue, if they're being spent now, are being spent after the crisis has passed. So we're adding to debt each and every day when what we should be doing is pulling back on it. I mean, that's our local position. Now, to take the other side of the argument, it's often that our debt levels are lower compared to the rest of the world. I don't think that is an argument. I really don't. Do you want to see what's happening in Eastern Europe happen here? Our economy is small, open, and hugely reliant on its interconnectedness with both Europe, Asia, and America. So we will have problems if they have problems, no matter what we do. So there is that reliance, on our export income, and the fact that if our markets deteriorate, and as people put it in simple terms, China stops buying our raw materials because America stops buying the goods that China makes, it's going to be very difficult for us to respond, particularly as we now have emptied the cupboard of all of our savings. So by responding in such a over-the-top, excessive way, and I would say a very political way, to the global financial crisis and pumping a total of $100 million into the economy, we've actually seen since 2008, we've actually seen Australia put itself in a position where, should there be a double dip in our recession, that we won't have any resources to meet it. And so when we talk about sovereign debt, that's what worries me.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on now. Final issue we'll talk about is asylum seekers. Now, electorates don't get more landlocked than Farah, and seem to have the least to fear with regards to boat people and border security on the surface. Are people in this electorate concerned about these issues and why?
They're probably not as concerned in this electorate as they would be if they lived in Darwin, where some of our defence forces are being asked to move out of their homes to make way for asylum seeker accommodation, or in northwest Western Australia, or even in parts of Queensland where the problem is more, if I can put it this way, more visible. But it is still an issue that gets raised with me, and I really mean that. And it is still an issue that eats away, I think, at a lot of Australians in a way that the current government hasn't really understood. We've seen their response to the asylum seeker problem change dramatically since Julia Gillard took over as Prime Minister, and there can only be one reason for that, and that is recognition of the feelings of concern that ordinary Australians have about it. So it is raised with me. Yeah, it's not people's number one issue, mm-hmm. but it's often raised with me.
Yep. How do we have a mature discussion nationally about asylum seekers and population related issues in a way that doesn't ignite the worst prejudices that exist in our community?
Look, the worst prejudices exist and will come out in many different forums. And I know people say they come out in the asylum seeker discussion, but they come out in many other discussions, let me tell you. And if you're a politician and you listen to the sort of conversations that we all hear from time to time, I don't think you don't have to be a politician, you will see the worst prejudices emerge. So I think that's a bit of a furphy. I don't think they're bringing out the worst prejudices. If people have a problem with people coming to Australia from certain parts of the world and they don't like to see them in their community, then that's going to manifest itself no matter what. I grew up in Muslim countries, and I maintain strong links with Muslim communities. I don't have any, very few in my electorate, very, very few. And I argue passionately to everyone who sends me one of those horrible emails that is telling us that we've got something to fear from Muslims, and I'm not going to describe the emails because I wouldn't give them that dignity. It doesn't matter who said, I will send them a very sharp reply and try to sort of correct that impression. And I think what we have to rely on is time to allow people to see that the threats that they might fear don't really exist. But you see, I don't see the asylum seeker issue in that context. I'm supportive of our approach. I think it's tough on individuals, but I don't think there's any alternative. In the parts of the world where I grew up, there are people there now who've been in refugee camps for 3, maybe 4 generations. And while our quota, if I can use that word, we can make the quota bigger, I'm happy for us to take more refugees, but our humanitarian intake is well above what the UN suggests and was in the previous government too. So we've always done a lot of heavy lifting when it comes to taking refugees, but I am still disappointed to see those places taken up by people who have the wherewithal to arrive here by boat, and I know that their individual circumstances are tough, when those who are waiting patiently in refugee camps around the world will never get that opportunity as long as we have the numbers of people arriving by boat that we do now. And that's just not fair.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and finally, to conclude, what message would you like to leave with the voters of Farah?
I would encourage everyone to think about their vote. I would encourage everyone to think carefully about their vote both in the lower house and the Senate, because we are likely to face a Senate where neither party has control after this election, and depending on your particular view, you may think that's a good thing, but you may not. So people often don't think about the Senate vote, but it is important that you do. The message from me is that I believe that I've worked very hard for the people of Farah, for the 250,000 square kilometres of Western New South Wales that I represent. And I love my job. I get up every morning wanting to achieve things. I disappoint myself sometimes, particularly when we're in opposition, when I can't help. But when we have wins, no matter how small and personal they are, but we really celebrate those, both me and the staff that help me out every day and do such a fantastic job. We get a great deal of happiness from solving people's problems when they walk into my office with something that seems to them insolvable. So I wouldn't demand that anyone vote for me, because voting is a personal thing and it's everyone's individual choice. But I would encourage them, if they have any questions about how they think I can or should represent them better, that they get in touch with me, and remind people that I do, I am hopelessly addicted to technology, and I do carry my BlackBerry everywhere, and people get emails from me at 3 o'clock in the morning because I happen to have woken up and think, well, I'll just check my BlackBerry, which is a terrible thing, I know. But that I do still respond personally to people, and I really enjoy doing that. So please Google me and then email me.
Susan Lee, thank you for participating in the FARA Candidates Forum.
Thank you so much.